Hello, everybody.
Hi. It's Witchy Bites.
Episode 39.
And I'm Liz.
And I'm Hanny. We've got an interview. I'm so excited.
So we're interviewing Eliza Henry Jones, who is an Australian author. We will let her introduce herself because she's brilliant. And honestly, she's such a joy of a person to talk to. We read her book, Salt and Skin.
Yes.
And it is set in the Scottish Isles.
The Northern Isles. Yeah, so it's set on a fictional take on the Orkney Isles. Yeah. But if you've been there, you can tell where it is. I really loved. I love that you could tell the different parts, even though they had different names and set out a little differently. I was like, oh, yeah, I know where that is. Oh, yeah, I know where that is. That's awesome. I really like that about it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, not that I've been there, but maybe one day. So Hannah and I both have read this book before the interview and we both enjoyed it.
It's great.
And we feel so lucky that we got to talk with Eliza.
I know. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
So take a listen. And, yeah, we loved doing the interview and we'll talk to you again afterwards.
I just want to say before we even start just how much I loved your book.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was really great.
Slightly annoyed about the ending that ended very abruptly.
The ending is proving to be very divisive.
Is it really?
Ooh. I got a message from my friend after it came out and it's just all in caps saying you have ruined my life. And then
that's the right response.
And then she said it's her 50th birthday this week and she has demanded that I write her an epilogue.
I mean, we're here for it. We're like, is there a sequel?
Yeah.
So when you release your epilogue, we want to hear it too.
Yeah, we're up for that. That's
great. I was just like, I think I even like audibly exclaimed. I was like, what? Ended here? Is that it?
Yeah, I don't think I made myself particularly popular with that ending.
It was a good ending.
It was good, but it was also like, I want some closure around this and this and this. But when it all sort of settled in, I was like, oh, but it was a good ending though.
It's a mean ending though for readers. It's a mean ending.
That's true. But you don't always have to make it easy for the reader.
This is true.
Like having a bit of a challenge is like, I can appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you want to introduce yourself and who you are and what you do?
Yes, I can remember that.
Yeah, you can do that.
We know it's early, but
So thank you so much for having me on your show today. My name's Eliza Henry Jones and I'm an author and a freelance writer based on a little flower farm on Wurundjeri land in the Yarra Valley. I've written 5 novels now, 2 of which are for young adults, and my latest novel, Salt and Skin, examines the witch trials in Orkney.
Which we loved.
Which you love.
Oh, look, I even do it without even realizing. So I guess one of our first questions is, what made you decide to write about witchcraft?
Well, it was kind of almost a little bit accidental. I read a memoir that I really, really loved called The Outrun by Amy Liptrot, and a friend sent it to me because they thought I'd really like the addiction side of things. But it's set in the Orkney Islands, and I became absolutely rapturously obsessed with the Orkney Islands and dragged my husband there. Was feeling really burnt out with writing at the time, so I left my laptop at home. I didn't even have a notepad. Like, I just was like, not going to write anything, which is so, like, that was like an out-of-body experience for me. And anyway, I went to the Orkney Islands, and they were absolutely phenomenal. And we did a tour of St. Magnus Cathedral, which is this beautiful sandstone kirk right in the centre of the capital of Kirkwall. And it's a very old kirk. They broke ground on it in 1137 when the Orkneys were still under Norse rule. And we went, we did a tour. And because we were there coming into winter, we were the only ones on the tour, which made us feel very special. And while we were on the tour, we saw Murrick's Hole, which is this dungeon up in the wall of the Kirk where they used to incarcerate people accused of witchcraft. Other crimes too, but it's most associated with the witch hunts during the 17th century. And it is shaped like the bottom of a champagne bottle, the floor. So they people that were incarcerated in there couldn't rest. And I think, you know, it's pretty well known that witch trials across, you know, witch hunts across the world kind of unevenly fell on women. And Orkney has even higher rates of charges against women. I think it was 90% of those accused of witchcraft during the witch hunts were women in Orkney. So they also had the double hangman's ladder that these majority women would be forced to climb to the gallows after they were convicted of witchcraft. And we also managed to find, they've since put a memorial on this site, but we managed to find the little grassy, little just like a little grassy patch on this suburban street where they actually had the gallows set up. So I think it was about a mile away from the Kirk. So when they were convicted, they were marched up this hill to this little, I can't even imagine what it would have looked like back in the 17th century, but could we marched up this hill to this little grassy patch, and that's where they were executed. So something about being confronted with these physical sites and these objects just really got in under my skin. And I sort of did a little bit of research, but it wasn't until I had my son that I actually turned this into a PhD. So Salt and Skin is a PhD, which was really cool because it sort of gave me the confidence to reach out to archivists and experts, and I'm sure they would have spoken to me regardless because they're all very lovely people, but it just gave me that sense of
it helps when you have an obsession
yes
about something. I'm so excited about this, I just have to talk to you about it. That would have helped, given you a bit of confidence. Yeah, I can see that.
And just being able to go through you know, the Kirk session records and go through, there's a great book that details the charges against three women. I think one is from Shetland and two are from Orkney. And there's an amazing witchcraft survey online where researchers have actually, I think it's through Edinburgh University, have actually compiled all of the witch hunts throughout Scotland, and they've sort of pieced together the person, who they were, what their occupation was, if it was known, what the charges were, where they were located, what the date the trial was, all that sort of thing. So that's been a really, really cool resource as well. But just something about these women's stories and the fact that these Kirk records, as imperfect and incomplete as they are often the most complete records of these women's day-to-day lives that exist now. And there's something so confronting about that.
Yeah. And part of it being that the records are, you know, in some ways made up, like their stories that they told to end their suffering, or you know, and that's really heartbreaking as well. So, yeah.
And just when you realise these people were, like, they had their whole lives, but they were almost entirely forgotten, except what is written, which may or may not be true in these records as well. And then you go there and you see these physical places and things that they interacted with, and it's just, yeah, quite confronting, really.
So confronting. And, you know, all these records will written by men, you know, literacy was the difference between literacy between men and women at that time in Scotland was incredibly stark. So, you know, women didn't have the capacity to leave written records in a lot of cases of their lives. And I think of those that were able to, those records were probably discarded over the years as being, you know, uninteresting or carrying less weight than the records written by men. So it's this whole multi-layered kind of gendered stuff going on.
Yeah, and realizing how little control they had over their lives because they couldn't even put it down in any kind of permanent way what they actually experienced, let alone any details about their lives, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can see why that would inspire you to want to write about that. Like, that's such a story to want to tell, even if it is in a fictional, you know, way. So yeah, for sure.
And it was kind of, it was the first time that I've really delved into something as richly historical and as richly peopled as the witch hunts in Scotland mm-hmm. and across Orkney. So I really get to grapple with, you know, how much can I deviate from what the records tell me? You know, how much can I twist things? What can I leave out? What should I put in? So just grappling with the stories of these very real people, even if they were from, you know, hundreds of years ago, was a new experience for me to navigate.
So what were some of the stories that inspired you to put into your book? What specific stories, which people?
There's one particular woman called Jeannette Reed, who was executed in the early 1600s, I think. And her records are one of the three that were detailed they were recorded in quite a lot of detail in this book, which was an absolute gift. And what struck me is that a lot of the accusations levelled against her were either quite innocuous or they were positive. And that's what's very striking again and again when you go through these records, that a lot of the charges will be, like, for instance, a man went to her and said, "Look, I've remarried. My first wife died, but a ghost is just bugging us, won't leave us alone. You know, can you do something about it?" Hanging around.
Just hanging around, hanging out.
So she went to the grave and basically said, you know, charged the spirit to lie still and, you know, stop it, basically. you know, there's that whole blurred line between witchcraft and, you know, inverted commas in this instance, and charming and healing and that sort of thing. So, and in some things that I read around the Scottish witch hunts highlighted that there had to be mention of the devil explicitly. The devil had to be involved in the charges, which I believe wasn't true for a lot of other places in Europe, wasn't true for England. And it resulted in torture being used quite a lot throughout the Scottish witch hunts, which is, I know, true in Orkney. So part of that was the dungeon with the champagne bottle floor. They used things like leg irons. One of the earliest women accused of witchcraft, Alison Bellflower, you know, they brought her husband and young child in and tortured them in front of her until she said, yes, I, you know, conspired with the devil, it's all true. And then she tried to recant later, but they, you know, wouldn't remove the conviction. And and Jeannette Reed as well, she was, you know, she tried to heal a sick child. There was another woman that was accused of raising a procession of the dead, which is a charge that I did thread into the narrative of Salt and Skin. There was just something so poetic and evocative, you know, raising a procession of the dead. You know, what is that? and then, you know, I was also struck by some of the charges that were promising fruitfulness in nature, and particularly, I mean, that's another thread that I do into Salt and Skin, but how that plays into a contemporary setting where climate change is such an ongoing global concern. And I think another thing that really, sorry, I'm just babbling here, but another thing that really fascinated me was the complexity, like the fact that so many different people were charged with witchcraft. You know, it was definitely skewed towards women who were from lower socioeconomic brackets, who were perhaps other disenfranchised. In a lot of those cases, I think the women would have actually sought out and built their reputation for being a witch, because it was it'll enable them to make a living. It gave them a standing in their community, even while they would have been othered for it. It's this strange kind of duality. But, you know, other women, I'm sure, and men would have just been accused because someone was feeling a bit malevolent towards them. I mean, in some instances, someone would have walked past a buyer and the cow would have died a year later, and then that could have been enough to have them dragged in and interrogated for witchcraft. And what was interesting is a lot of the men accused of witchcraft, those accusations were in relation to a primary crime committed by a woman. It was rare for a man to be accused in and of himself. And it was also interesting too, because during the torturing that happened to a lot of these people, which is absolutely horrifying, they were encouraged to name other witches, because there was this whole idea of the coven and meeting together and all of that sort of thing. And so you ended up with these kind of peaks in charges and convictions, because people would, you know, point finger wildly to make the torture stop. And then those people would get pulled in and that end up getting accused. And yeah, it's there's a beautiful, beautiful collection of lyric essays by Catherine Nuremberger called The Witch of Eye. And she talks about how, you know, sometimes, you know, the community will ask the witch for things for survival, and other times they will point the finger at the witch for survival. And I think that's particularly true when you consider the fact that consulting a witch was also considered executable offence. So, yeah, it's just a lot of people trying to save themselves in a lot of ways, I think.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, horrible to think about how much, like, trauma would come out of all of that as well. Like, you know, like the little child watching her mother being tortured and then confessing to consorting with the devil, you know, it's kind of like, and just living in that community in fear. Or would it be a case of, like, feeling like you're in denial and safe from that until it happens to you? Like, just so many themes around that are so, I guess, sad and heartbreaking, and it's hard to imagine what it's like living in that kind of way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I love that you raised that. I've been so preoccupied with that, whether people did live in fear or whether they had this false sense of safety, like whether they didn't realise there were even whispers of them being a witch until they were dragged in to the kirk.
Yeah.
Or whether, you know, it was just a risk they had to take in order to live and have a little bit of independence.
It makes me think about, I don't know if you've watched Leah Remini's Scientology documentary.
No.
That she did. It's fantastic. It's on Stan. So she talks a lot about how Scientology, you think that you'll never be considered a suppressive person, so someone who's dangerous to the church.
Mm.
Until it happens to you. And she's like, you think you are a good person and you do, like, good things, but you suddenly disagree with their ideology, and then
that's all it, like, takes.
And and they're like, I never imagined that it would happen to me. So yeah, if you get a chance to watch it, it's great. But
yeah, that sounds so good.
And heartbreaking. Mm. Yeah. It's quite fascinating. Mm. Yeah. I guess that kind of leads me into thinking about, I guess that you focused a lot on, like, the historical sides of witchcraft. Obviously, that's what we're really fascinated with, as being a witchcraft podcast. But what about the contemporary side? Did you look at any of that, or was that something completely out of scope for writing the book?
I read quite a few memoirs. Which was really cool. And I went on to – I did a fair bit of reading, but – I guess it was more tangential to the story, because a lot of the witchcraft is kind of more historical, and I think it's almost even a little bit historical in how it bleeds into the contemporary. I'd say the contemporary representations of witchcraft and salt and skin, line more closely with the historical than the more contemporary experiences and stories that I encountered. I haven't had that question before.
Well, I did notice some things, like certainly Cassandra's character was very much contemporary witchcraft. So that was,
That's how we read her.
Yeah. For us. And even August, like that wild woman who, you know, just ran around the island in nature. Like how beautiful was she? Like, yeah, loved August.
And I did a interview yesterday and this blew my mind, but Andrew, the guy who was interviewing me, mentioned that it's almost like I was building, I almost had the crone, the mother and the maiden between Iris, Cassandra and Min, which kind of blew my mind a little bit. I'm like, wow, that was completely intentional.
I would definitely be claiming it being intentional. Yeah. It was so there. Yeah, it was. And their relationships all together, like all the women in your story were so strong in so many ways.
It was nice.
Yeah, and it was such a fun thing to read as well. Yeah. Like even though they weren't perfect people, you know, they were so strong. Yeah.
They were strong. Yeah. And don't want to do spoilers, but, you know, I think there's a real kind of pressure, and I think it's internal and external, but when you're writing kind of, you know, a wild young woman like Min is, that, you know, she does, there is that kind of idea that she needs to meet someone or have that thread of romance in her arc. And I was like, you know what? Nah. No.
I have to say, when I was reading it, I thought, oh, no, is there going to be some kind of romance with Min? And I didn't want it.
Mm.
I didn't want a curtailing of her wildness in that way. I was like, just keep going. Just keep going. Off you go. Don't do that. And you didn't. I was so happy. So I'm with you on that. I was so happy. She just kept going on her arc of development and on her own, and I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And her arc's kind of like about, it's almost towards more independence and more like a joyful kind of aloneness, because, you know, when she arrives on the island, she is so preoccupied and immobilized by what people think, and all she wants to do is just fit in, and she's almost you know, it's almost this like calculating scientific right, you know, how do I disappear into this new, you know, school crowd. And then by the end, she's just joyfully in her own skin, which is a really, really lovely, lovely arc to delve into.
Is that where Salt and Skin, the title, came from? Was that part of that inspiration or?
Ooh. I think Salt and Skin for me, I just kind of liked how it sounded. I was like, that's kind of fun. And I think for me it kind of speaks to, you know, salt being this elemental thing, salt being, you know, in the ocean, salt being around, you know, sweat and passion and grief, and also, you know, and skin, just the boundaries between the human and the non-human skin, you know, marked on the context. Because I'm sure people haven't read it yet. There's the little island of Shawnee where this family moved to has a kind of magical twist to it, where some people can see cross hatchings of every scar that a person, every luminous marks highlighting every injury a person has ever sustained, and so that played into it. You know, skin and the Selkie folklore. You know, the skin, the fur seal skin. So all of that kind of played into the title. And then we kind of talked about changing the title, but my publisher and I, but then we decided that it was the right fit, Salt and Skin.
Good.
I agree.
And for me, the title was even quite witchy, because the salt is an integral part of witchcraft, well, some branches of witchcraft now as well, and skin just, well, they're sky-clad where rituals are done naked if people choose. So skin is also quite an important sort of, I don't know, for me it sort of would symbolise that. So it's even a really witchy title, so I liked it. I loved it.
I did have the salt in my mind, in the back of my mind too, like not initially, but then the more research I did into witchcraft, because that's another thing the Scottish Witchcraft Survey really details, is the instruments and tools that people used, and salt came up a lot, and again in a lot of the contemporary research I did, salt was
it's perfect.
Yeah, it's great.
it's so cool, though. I remember I got given a book called Spells for Teenage Witches when I was about 11, and I was absolutely obsessed with it. And I used to carry it around with me everywhere. And then one of my mum's partners stapled it to my study roof as a prank. And I was like, I'm okay with this. Oh. No, as a this was as an adult. I had outgrown Spells for Teenage Witches.
Okay, right,
yes.
I see.
Yes.
It wasn't when you were 11. Okay.
No, right, he did not, you know, drag the, you know, my beloved book off me and put it out of reach. No, it was like a joke.
Adult prank.
Yeah. And I'm like, right. No, I quite like having it on the roof of my study, you know, thank you.
Yeah. Oh no. I guess stepping back to one of the things you're talking about men's development and things like that, we've really noticed a theme of liminal spaces in your book. So there might be a couple of spoilers, so people might want to skip 30 seconds.
Yes.
Like, you know, you mentioned the island disappearing, where sea meets land, Luda's ghosts for sure are part of that space. Even Theo's existence, like, you know. And obviously, like, Cassandra in the other world and even Luda and Tristan after their accident. Was it important to you to create these liminal spaces for us, for the reader? And do you consider these spaces important for psychology and trauma as well?
Absolutely. Liminal, that was kind of like the word that was like drumming through my head during the whole writing and editing process, you know, just like covered in chocolate and like greasy hair stuck up. It's like liminal, liminal, liminal. And, you know, that's exactly what I thought. And that's, I think, what drew me to a lot of the themes explored in the book is that liminality. And I think, you know, trauma itself is kind of existing in this liminal space where you're existing in the present, but also the past is existing in the present with you. Grief forces you to exist in a liminal space. And the kind of yearning, unspoken love that underpins most of the character relationships in Salt and Skin is also a kind of liminality where, you know, it's like a simmering static space. It still has a lot of vitality to it. And I think that real focus on the liminal felt right for Salt and Skin because it does have that focus on the environment. It does look at intersections, you know, between past and the present and what's real and what's not real, what's in the, you know, the nature and human, the spoken and unspoken, the documented and the undocumented. When I was doing my research, there's an amazing, she's a cultural geographer, but Madril, and she talks about presence, absence, and how, you know, absence can be a very active thing rather than this kind of passive void. And that felt very true to me, just considering St. Magnus as a space in and of itself, and the women's stories and how much, you know, through these fragmented records that remain now, you know, the absence of everything else feels very living, and very present during the research process.
That's a very good point about the St. Magnus being a liminal space and like being in that space and not knowing your outcome, having probably a fairly good idea what your outcome's going to be and just waiting, like, yeah, it's torture in its own self.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And particularly when, you know, some of these people were from these really remote islands on Orkney. You know, Orkney's made up of many, many islands and, you know, some of them would have been dragged to Kirkwall. And that was the first time they'd been away from home. And just being in, it would have felt like a, you know, bustling, it would have felt like New York or, you know, just unbelievably cosmopolitan and alien and unfamiliar. And there was an amazing artist and academic and researcher. She was an artist. Her name's just popped out of my head because it is early on a Saturday morning. but She was an artist in residence at St. Magnus Cathedral.
Wow, cool.
And she was very preoccupied with giving the women back their names and the sounds of home. So she actually read out their names in the dungeon space, and she took recordings of the more remote islands where a lot of these women came from and actually played them in the dungeon, which I just thought was so beautiful and so striking. I think you can Google St. Magnus Artist in Residency, and she kept a blog, which was absolutely amazing. It's really, really good reading.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. What an art piece.
That's
beautiful,
so
isn't
powerful.
It?
Mm. Yeah. And I love that these stories are being told so long after the fact, and these people being given their identities back, other than being witch
and victim even.
And victim.
Yeah. They have a life now rather than just they were the victim of time, the times kind of thing. Yeah.
And that's something I really wanted to try and explore. I don't know how. I think I may have gotten a little bit sidetracked in the actual novel, but I was very, and it is something that some of the characters talk about, that, you know, there's a lot of kind of sensationalism around the witch hunts, and you know, I think sometimes how these women's lives ended completely overshadows how they lived and the fact that they were people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you do get that across in the book.
Well, that's nice.
But maybe not like the witch trials, but the women whose babies are, you know, under the hedge, I think that kind of gives them their story as well, you know, like... Yeah, so another spoiler. Sorry, people.
And I've just looked up the artist's name because that was going to bug me. Sheena Graham George is the artist who did that beautiful project at St. Magnus with the sounds.
Oh, fantastic. I'll put it in the show notes. So one of the things we particularly loved about the book, like really spoke to us, was just the wildness and the elements that came across, like the elemental aspects of the book. When you went to the Scottish Isles, is that something that spoke to you as well, that energy and that the elements?
Yeah, what was the experience of being there like?
Yeah.
It felt like coming home in a lot of ways. And this is a funny little aside, but I knew I had a Scottish relative who'd been in the south of Scotland, but that was all. And then I did an ancestry. My mum got me an ancestry test for a birthday, I think it was, because a lot of my heritage is unknown for a lot of reasons. And it actually came back as being 50% associated with Highlands and Orkney. So this was when by this stage I was eyeball deep in my PhD and the book and completely immersing myself in, you know, the Highlands and Orkney. And so that was just really weird, like out of all the places in the world. Highlands and Orkney, 50%.
I think our DNA knows. I think it knows the feeling of home.
Yeah.
And where it's come from. Like we do often talk about like spirits of place and how fit into those
genius Loki. Places. Loki, is that?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah.
Loki. Thank you.
Depends on how you pronounce it. we understand and we can and it's a big part of the conversations that happen around witchcraft, particularly as people who live in Australia and we're living on a land that we may be born to, but our ancestry isn't from necessarily, that's a huge conversation. So I can see how that happens and how you can feel like home when you go somewhere where your body just recognizes it.
It was really an unsettling experience because I hadn't even been to the Northern Hemisphere before, but after I was just like, no, we have to go to Orkney, and I had to go there. And and normally I really like quite lush, warm, temperate places. I'm not a big, cold, windy, rainy person, And I remember I've talked about this quite a lot, but when my husband and I arrived on the islands, we went out to our hire car. It was so windy, we couldn't even get the doors of the hire car open. And my husband, who really likes, you know, snow and wild places, he was happy, but he's just sort of looking at me going like, why did you want to come here? Like,
what's going on? Are you okay?
He's like, this is great, but like, what? And, you know, it is so wild out there. There's not that many trees. It used to be very heavily forested, I believe, but because it's been used for agriculture for so long, it's very sparse, and a lot of the trees are actually braced with metal because the wind is just so ferocious. I mean, the Orkney Islands, the whole of the Northern Isles, they're, you know, right in the middle of the Atlantic and the North Sea, and they get absolutely hammered by weather. It's a lot milder than you'd think because it's up near kind of Norway and Iceland, really. But it's in the Gulf Stream, which kind of insulates a lot of the – it would be absolutely wild there without the Gulf Stream. And I think – and just the ocean and the animals and how accessible the historical sites were. You know, you've got Scarabray, you've got these standing stones, you've got Maze Howe, which is this kind of chambered tomb that Vikings hung out in many, 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 many years ago and, like, carved, you know, I think they were waiting out a storm, so, like, they carved all this graffiti into this, you know, Iron Age, I think it was Iron Age, like, Neolithic tomb. And just, and I think as you were saying, like, it's a, I think in Australia so much of that history is inaccessible, and we've been part of destroying it, and our ancestors have been part of destroying it, and you know, it's a complicated thing to navigate, I think. Because Australia has a incredible human history, but it's just, it's so much of it has been lost.
You just made me really think about how, in some ways, the way that we can protect what's here now is through trying to battle things like climate change and looking after our landscape and environmentalism and things like that. So, yeah, sure, we've done really terrible things, like horrible, horrible things that we can't change. But how do we move forward from that? And I do think protecting what's here and trying to battle climate change, as I said, would be one way to do it.
Yeah, and like what you know, what does that look like? And how do you engage with something that's so enormous and so draining? You know, it's such a hard thing to engage with for any sort of length of time. You know, it's a huge thing to grapple with.
Oh, I'm going to ask. This is sort of Liz put this together, but I really like this question. One of the most powerful moments for both of us, but Liz brought it up in the book, was when Luda etched the hex foils onto Tristan's skin. And Liz, you were saying for you it really felt like it was a moment of her being like a witch. And from the outside it looked like she'd lost her mind, but the loss of her inhibition to live in her knowing was just so powerful. So I wanted to know about writing that scene. Was that... like, how was that for you? And was it particularly affecting as you were writing it, or was there something else that was, like, were there scenes that were difficult to write? Were there ones that you just afterwards you were like, oh, wow, like, I feel really pumped after getting that down in the way that I wanted, or just inspired by, you know, what you got your characters to do?
That is one of my favourite kind of moments in the novel, and I don't think anyone's really asked me about it, which I've been a bit bummed about, so thank you. Oh.
It was Liz. Liz really liked that. I was like,
it was my favourite part of the book.
So true. Yeah.
I became absolutely obsessed with hexafoils and, you know, apotropaic markings, protective marks, and witch marks. They're known by a lot of different things. But what I've lost my train of thought. Oh, yes. So I became really interested. I was just I have ADHD and I get stuck in rabbit holes. Like I'll go down research, like I'll just like Google something and then 5 hours later I'll kind of emerge a little bit, you know, cross-eyed. But something I stumbled upon was there's a cave network called the Creswell Crags, south of Sheffield in England. And there are all of these markings in these caves. And they just thought it was kind of, you know, Victorian graffiti and didn't really think much of it. But then some experts went through and they're like, no, these are protective spells. And one hypothesis as to why there's such a heavy concentration of these markings in these caves is that it was viewed as the gateways to hell. And all of those markings were there to keep the devil and bad spirits at bay, you know, to trap them there. And I just love the way that hexafoils kind of are this embodiment of, you know, magic and trauma and the environment. And I began researching them and I got very excited because there's actually a few examples in St. Magnus Cathedral of these markings. So I got very excited about that. And then I nearly lost my mind because I started doing, looking at, you know, if there's any in Australia, and it seemed a little bit far-fetched. And there's the, have you heard of the Australian Magic Research Project? Yeah.
We've done an episode on it.
I need to listen to that. I haven't listened to that one. I absolutely lost my mind because I just kept trying to find these patterns and links between Orkney and Australia, because what drew me to these places, aside from, you know, the witch hunts and the witch trials, and it was how both Australia and the Orkney Islands are at the forefront of climate change, and a lot of studies will look at Orkney and Australia. You know, there's both these communities are in a way you know, grappling with similar things, but they couldn't be more elementally disparate. I became so struck by the fact that you know, these, even though invasion wasn't until 1788, which, you know, obviously is a lot later, you know, than you would expect people. It's a much later time than what you would expect. Words, Eliza. You wouldn't necessarily expect people in 1788 to be engaging in creating hexafoils and witch marks.
Yeah.
But something just unsettled, you know, something about the people that were already in Australia, something about the environment, something about the animals just unsettled them, and they reverted back to these older practices to keep themselves and their loved ones safe and to give them a sense of empowerment and safety, I guess, in this place that unsettled them. And I just was really struck by that and how it fits into this pattern of people, of these fragments of history repeating over generations, and how that ties into trauma and how that ties into women's stories. And it just... Yeah, I got so excited. I'm sure you can imagine how excited I was when I worked out that you know, it was, you know, they're in Australia. Like, why are they in Australia? This is wonderful. And, you know, in Salt and Skin, you know, climate change is obviously I didn't want to like hit people over the head with it, because everyone knows that, you know, climate change is a really big thing, and, you know, people don't want to have it sort of jammed down their throat, and, you know, like, it's, so I didn't, but I did want to explore it. And one of the things that was important to me is that, I think it's Darcy later in the book, Luda's son, you know, he's walking along a street on Big Island, and he notices that people have started carving hexafoils onto the fronts of their houses. And that ties into, yeah, like Luda marking Tristan to keep him safe, Tristan's body to keep him safe. And you know, the ghost house where the Manigans live on the little island of Shawnee, you know, the walls are absolutely coated in hexafoils, and there's a lot of discussion about, you know, what do these marks mean? You know, are they malevolent? Are they benevolent? Why did they feel like they needed so much protection? Like, what were they scared of? So anyway, yes, long story short, I love that scene, and I got very excited by hexafoils.
Did you get a chance to talk to Dr. Ian Evans about hexafoils, or?
No, I got too, like, shy and overwhelmed.
He went to my parents' house to check to see if they had hexafoils at their house.
That's amazing. Because he started focusing on Tasmania, didn't he? And then he's more recently found that there's actually markings in quite a lot of dwellings on the mainland as well, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
So cool.
Yeah.
So cool. Thinking I need a hexafoil tattoo one day. Like,
yes.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
I've been thinking that. I actually got a tattoo. I don't know whether you can see it. It's Fiat Lux. So it's one of the stained glass windows at St. Magnus.
Wow. Cool. This really went into
it. Really did. It's never happened to me before. Like, I've never become, I mean, I'm a pretty obsessive person, but this was like a new bar
new
for me.
Yeah.
And I've never even got a tattoo before. So, you know.
Wow.
And my 68-year-old mum, you know, she's always thought, you know, tattoos are, you know, they're a bit rough, you know, that real blue, they're a bit rough. And when I told her I was going to get Fiat Lux, which means, you know, it's let there be light, and it's from the Book of Genesis, but I just love, like let there be light, and that just seemed to just tie into what I was trying to do with salt and skin. And anyway, I told her I was going to get this tattoo on my finger, and she's like, oh, I'm going to get that too. So my mother and I have matching tattoos.
Oh my god, that's so awesome. And that's her first tattoo as well, I'm guessing.
And on your fingers, like, that's ow.
Also very, very seeable. Like, people can see it. So yeah, I love that.
I'm a bad influence on my mother.
I'm glad it's gone that way.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That's fantastic.
I guess you just made me also think about, was there a relationship for you when you were writing, like, about, because you're talking about skin and marking skin, but, like, also the hexafoils on the houses, like, did you see them as being related in some way?
Absolutely. And just, I really wanted the hexafoils to be kind of this thread in the narrative that kind of broke down the human and the natural world, which I think is such a big part of witchcraft, you know? And part of that too was, you know, the scars, you know, whales beach themselves pretty early on in the novel on the little island, and they've got all the scars on their faces like people do. So, you know, I guess just trying to break down and challenge this idea that humans are inherently more important or more complex or more worthy than the other, you know, the natural world and animals and the non-human.
I love that. Yeah.
Actually, I got that when you were talking about the scars on the whales. I was like, oh yeah, I could see. I can
see
what you
doing.
Just said. Yeah, I got it there. I said, oh, yeah, like, this is a breakdown of that barrier that we put up between us and almost anything other, especially, like, in nature. Like, it's the barrier's artificial. It's us that's doing it, it's not actually there. Yeah, I really felt that when that came up. And then I was like, oh, but the whales are dying. I don't like this scene. I got through it though; it was fine. But yeah,
that did make me sad. I did. Yeah. That I did get sad with that scene, and I got. So I think you asked earlier, and I sidetracked myself, which is pretty on brand for me. But I found, I think, a lot of Darcy's thread quite hard to write. Not that it was necessarily distressing, but just, you know, Darcy has this trauma backstory which is hinted at throughout the narrative, and I was so aware of trying to do it justice and explore it in a way that is never verbalized.
We discussed that actually.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I think Liz got it. I didn't as much, but that's fun.
That was a really big thing for me because I think so often, and I've done it in my other books, but you sort of dangle this traumatic backstory early on in the novel, and you know, people are nosy and they're going to keep reading because they want to know what happened to this character. And I just thought, well, that's not my experience of trauma. And, you know, having worked in community services and, you know, had the humbling privilege of working with people who have experienced huge trauma, it doesn't ring that true. I mean, some people, people are able to, you know, verbalize their trauma and they're able to actually pull it into a narrative and tell someone that they trust, and it is this amazingly healing moment for them. But so often, you know, people might not even be able to piece together what happened to them. You know, traumatic memories, they exist very differently to other memories. They're not processed in the same way. They're not held in the brain in the same way. And, you know, I just wanted to have this thread where this character actually never tells anyone what's happened to him. You know, readers can piece it together, but he never says anything, and he's still nurtured and loved and seen and validated. And I really wanted that in the story.
It's powerful, and it took until I kind of figured it out for me to go, oh, I actually understand Darcy now. Like, I couldn't understand why he was so hurt by certain things in his life. And it made me, like, really admire him in some ways because of what he has been carrying. And it also made me really admire Tristan as well, like that side of him that's so able to see people and who they are and to see when they need help and to put himself in that space to help them move forward, you know, even though he did it so naturally without really long conversations, you know, he just could figure it out. So, honestly, Tristan is like the unsung hero of that entire book. He was beautiful.
Yeah.
I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun with Tristan and a friend, one of my very, very favourite, most beautiful writer friends emailed me after reading it, and she said that, you know, he's just the classic, like, securely attached, you know.
Yeah. So beautiful.
Actually, we even talked about the different elemental, like the elements that the different characters could represent, and Tristan was very earthy.
Oh,
yes, that is.
And he was even the archaeologist, and we were like, oh, that's so cool.
Was that deliberate?
I guess no.
So he was the grounding, earthing kind of element to the people in this, like the characters in the story, as well as like holding the family together as, you know, that was our interpretation. And yeah, so we were like, oh, he's the earth element, and we talked about what the other characters sort of represented, but
I'm obsessed with that take. That was not conscious at all.
No, you're supposed to take credit for it.
Oh, yeah, that was completely, completely intentional, yeah.
Not our reading at all.
I'm trying to remember what our other theories were. Who did we assign the other elements to?
I thought Min was water, obviously.
Yeah.
But also Cassandra could have been watery, or spirit, because she had the witchy kind of thing happening.
Love Cassandra.
I thought Luda was fiery because she was really passionate but kind of at times uncontrolled with her emotion and how she processed, and that leaves air. And I thought Darcy was airy because he was all up in his head, but
an intellectual
I am living for this. So cool.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, we had a really in-depth discussion about this.
Yeah, completely intentional. I really love my elemental symbolism.
I guess on that vein, we kind of want to know about where you find magic in your life. Like, what kind of things in your life, like, give you that spark of
Besides the Orkney Islands.
Besides that's it.
I think for me it's largely we live on a we round it up to 8 acres, but really it's 7.5.
You're
7.5 acre, my 8 acre farm. And we grow a lot of our own food, and I do a little flower farm with my cousin. So we grow a lot of flowers from seed, and there's just something. It is magic. Like, it feels magical. And I mean, I spend a lot of my time, you know, swearing and, you know, yelling, you know, having these beautiful dreams where I can just like click my fingers and every slug in my patch just like eviscerates. Or like, you know, and we don't really use chemicals. So, I also have dreams where I just get glyphosate and just spray all the weeds and just like with a gun. And just but anyway, there's something so, grounding and so visceral and so powerful about planting a seed and having it grow into something beautiful or something nourishing. And just, and I grew up in the inner suburbs and I thought gardening was pretty boring. So it's pretty funny that I spend a lot, you know, a lot of my life, you know, up to my elbows in mud now. But there's something so, just magic about growing things and the seasonality and watching, you know, the pattern of the seasons shift. And, you know, like I know now as soon as we get a couple of warm days in September, you know, all the different birds come out and start, you know, the sound of the place changes. You know, the lizards come out. We've got a lot of blue tongues where we are. And also how this feels, you know, I've just painted this very idyllic picture, but also how climate change impacts the little microcosm of our farm. Like, you know, I've talked about this a bit too lately, but you know, last year we had a really bad cold snap over a weekend in November, and that killed hundreds of beehives in the Yarra Valley because the bees were in a, you know, normally they just bunker down over winter and they're fine with cold temperatures, but because they're in like a growth phase and they were busy building the hive up, they just weren't in a position to weather it. So, you know, my friend lost his two hives that he kept on our place. We had to feed ours sugar water for weeks afterwards just to get them through. And then of course they were so weak that a lot of our berries in our orchard didn't get pollinated. So we had a really low yield of raspberries and blueberries. And it's just that flow on. And then, you know, like late seasons, so you know the flowers bloom really late. I don't know, it's just it's a very engrossing thing to be part of. And the other thing I think that kind of gives me magic and gives me that spark and flair is I've got horses, so and particularly, you know, you sort of have heart horses. You have horses that you just click with. And you know, my heart horse, I used to just go galloping out with him in the bush. I'd tie my reins to the saddle and I'd just stick my arms out. And I used to like going out in storms and I'd just gallop with my arms stuck out. And the communication that happens between you and this, you know, half a ton animal without speaking, although I swear up in the world. But, you know, like the, you know, when your horse is in sync with you and you know them well, you know, you just almost have to think canter, or you think you want to turn and the horse will do it. And there's something, again, just that physicality and how visceral and magical and wordless it is. So that's a pretty special thing that I get to do.
Well, you've just given me lots of warm. And that explains why you're so good at explaining the elements in the books. Like, you're so entrenched with them being in nature so much. So,
but it was really funny because I wrote most of Salt and Skin during lockdown, and I had got a grant. I was very lucky to go to the Orkney Islands. I got a grant from the Australia Council to do research, and I was all booked in, had my little Airbnbs all teed up, and then COVID happened, so I couldn't actually get back there.
That's not fair.
And I was able to conduct a lot of the research from home. It's not the same as actually being able to immerse yourself. And during lockdown, because we were in, even though we're you know, about an hour and a bit outside of Melbourne, we're still technically counted as metro. So we were in the heavy lockdown. So I couldn't even get to any real water. I couldn't even get to the, we hang out at the Yarra River a little bit up in Warburton, but couldn't get to that. Couldn't even get to Port Phillip Bay to, you know, paddle my pale little feet in the water. You know, I was so removed from the ocean and just trying to write a story that just revolved around it in a lot of ways. But I think in a way, I mean, you know, in a way it made things really difficult and, you know, it's not how I would have chosen to do it, but it kind of meant that this story took on this kind of dreamlike quality a little bit. And I think that came through in the prose. Cause I had to dream it up because I was, you know, I mean, it was a beautiful place to be in lockdown. I'm so grateful for that, but it was not, I think
it's not the obvious place.
In a lot of ways, you'd be hard pressed to find a more elementally, you know, we're on, you know, rolling lush hills and tree ferns and mountain ash, and you know, it's all very green and treed, and so just trying to write this, you know, flat wild islands is just
you got the yearning for them across, actually.
Oh yay.
it gave me the feeling of like wanting to be there and immersing myself in it, so yeah, you did get that across, even if it was unintentional.
Completely intentional. That is the theme of today's talk. Yeah, intentional.
We really only have one other question for you. And, I mean, we have more questions, but I think we've covered quite a lot. But we want to know if you're going to write more on witchcraft.
I'd love to.
Because you could.
I'd love to. And there's so much I wasn't able to explore. You know, Salt and Skin's 100,000 words, and during the editing process, I threw out about 150,000 words. you know, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, I kind of started to explore or wanted to explore, and it just no longer served the purposes of the narrative. I would really, really love to write more about witchcraft, because it's just... It was a magical thing to explore. I hate myself a little bit after saying that.
We're definitely leaving it in. I'd be excited to read it, honestly.
Thank you.
So, yes. Honestly, it's been an absolute joy to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been a joy to talk to you both.
Good.
Oh, thank you. And we really look forward to see what else you're going to be doing in the future.
I'm swearing at my horses and plastering myself in chocolate, probably.
That actually seems like the dream life, so. thank you so much, Eliza.
No, thank you. Thank you. This was a really, really fun conversation, so thanks again for having me.
Oh, that's great. We loved having you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, that interview was such a joy.
That was really great. I really enjoyed the interview with Eliza. She was wonderful to talk to.
Yeah. And it just makes me love her book even more.
Yeah, so. I know. I was very tempted a few times to ask about more spoilery kind of things, but I did stop myself because we do actually want people to read it.
Yes, probably should have warned that there were going to be spoilers in the interview, but I think we kept them kind of down low. So, and like the book really spoke to me in a way that I hadn't anticipated. Like it took me a while to warm up. Like the first bit of the book was I had to warm up to the characters and fall in love with them. But when I did fall in love with them, I just really enjoyed everything about this book.
And I really liked the Orkney Islands almost, well, the take on the Orkney Islands, because they weren't quite. She had added some fictionalization, but I tell you, not too much. And they felt like, they almost felt like another character to me as well. Like
the island was a character.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I felt like the island was so alive.
Yeah.
It's really hard to put into words how much the island really spoke to me, and I felt like embodied in that space.
Yeah. Yeah. And like the way the weather interacted with the island, like it really, because it does, that's what it's like there. And it, I don't know, it just seemed so alive. I can't think of any more words. It was just brilliant. Yeah.
We've talked them out.
Yeah, we have.
And I just found everyone, like, we didn't even talk about Iris in the interview.
I know.
A character who is equally as amazing. Like, she's a bit more of a standard person that you know than maybe some of the other people. And yet she is so amazing, even though you may not appreciate her in that way to begin with.
Yeah, like she seems almost like a, I suppose, a bit of a stickler for rules, that kind of thing. Like, this should be like this, that should be like that. Yeah.
I always raise my hand because I'm such a rules person. Yeah.
But in the end, she showed that she's just this really strong character, really strong woman and really strong character, and she... Yeah, she's just, because of the space she took up in the book, like she didn't understand as much about some of the things that were happening because they were sort of outside of her expectations, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But she could do the right thing, the things that needed to be done, even if she didn't understand, which I liked. Like, she could take that, I don't know about this, or I'm unsure about this. It seems not how it should be, but I can still go with it and do what I think is right, which to me, that spoke to me a lot, like going out and doing what she needed to do with still that element of unknown or not sure, which I think a lot of us, especially now, can relate to. I don't know what's going to happen, don't know what's, you know, what exactly is the right thing to do, or like this sort of unknown, almost magical thing is going on or happening, and I'm not really sure, but I can still go ahead and do what I think is the right thing to do, or that is the right thing to do as well.
I mean, I guess the thing about Iris is that she's the kind of person that wants to fit into society and the way that it is, and maybe that's because you feel like she maybe didn't grow up in that way. So, but she's not a pushover.
No.
Like, yeah, and that's so beautiful. And I know we're talking spoilers and
a little. I tried to keep it not spoilery.
We're keeping it vague, but when you read this book, like, do pay attention to Iris.
Yeah.
She's more than meets the eye. So
I really liked her.
Yeah.
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 I mean, I liked the characters. Like, some of them, yeah, took me longer to get, I suppose, get used to. Grow to love, but in the end, I loved the community. Like, I loved them all; they were wonderful. No one really; they all came to mean something good to me,
except Father Lee.
Well, he just did what I thought he would do. He didn't change, so he lived down to expectation.
I find I found Father Lee. Very challenging in some ways, because I know people like him in real life, like growing up with fundamentalist cousins and relatives, and, you know, them determining how you should live your life was
whereas I grew up basically not quite, but sort of like Iris.
Yeah.
Myself, always trying to fit in, but with not a totally wild mum, but a mother who was definitely much more accepting of the spiritual side of life. So, yeah, different experience. Shrug. Everyone has different experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's probably why I loved Iris.
Yeah. 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 Oh. Everyone, even the barmaid was cool.
Yeah, Louise. Louise. I don't know why I remember that, but I do. I'm sure her name was Louise. And everyone felt very authentic. Like, she wrote them. Eliza wrote them well. I have to say.
It was great. And
wonderful, wonderful novel. We highly, highly recommend.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, when you're reading it, like, really think about like the witchcraft themes that are in this book, so we touched on it quite a lot in this podcast.
Yeah.
They are very subtle, like they're not in your face
yeah.
necessarily. They're kind of almost like a parallel
to the story. It's magical realism, which I love, and even not hugely, but it was just, it was enough for me. It was very realistic story, like it wasn't completely fantasy in any way really. And it came up a bit more at the end, obviously. But it was really grounded in realism, so it's not like it's gonna, you know, it's not a sword and sorcery story at all. But
no.
The witchcraft, yes, yeah, more it's in the historical context and it bleeds into the modern day, which I really like it.
Yeah. Yeah. And sorry, Eliza, you probably won't agree with this, but when you were talking about, like, your love of nature and being out in the elements.
And your flower farm. I'm
just sitting here going, witch, you're a witch.
In the most complimentary way you can imagine. It was like,
obviously, because we love witches.
This is why she writes so well about witchcraft, even in that historical sense. It's like she gets the basis that we feel, like what we think is the basis of magic and witchcraft. She gets it.
So, yeah, which is, why we identify so hard. Yeah. And, it was just fantastic.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. And it made me smile so much. I was like, when she was like going on about the elements and the bee bit made me sad. But the riding the horse in the storms, and I was just like, oh, yeah. That's like the core of my spirit.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah. She totally, totally got it. And it's really nice because sometimes, you know, people will write about things and they are entitled to things that are outside their own experience. But sometimes I think, especially if it's something really important to you, like witchcraft, if people choose to write about it, sometimes, like, I would worry they'd get it wrong or there'd be a slight implication in a story that I didn't like, because to me it's so personal. But when I heard Eliza talking and after reading the book, I was like, that's why it's so good. That's why she got it. She got it because she gets it. She might not say she might not claim the title, but we're calling her honorary. I hope she finds it a compliment because it's meant to be. But that's it. And I like that. And it really, doing this interview made me feel even better about it. I was like, yes, just write more on witchcraft, please, because you should.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I did want to say to her, please write August's story.
Oh my god, I want August's story.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a hard way to say August's story so much.
It's just her life story. Like a fictionalized version of her life story. You know, I don't know when she would have grown up, but that bit of time back on the Orkney Islands as a witch, just do that. Please.
And like, seeing Iris and Cassandra as in younger. The youth.
Yeah.
How amazing would that be? All right, that has to happen. I hope you listen to this interview again, Eliza, because I really want you to do this. That or I'm going to email you.
Yes. I have this idea. Totally just going to give to you, please.
Yeah.
So just do it just for us.
Yeah. Send us the epilogue.
Yeah. Actually, I don't even mind if there's no epilogue, but write August's story, please.
Please. Did you find, because we just in Tassie had a bunch of whales beach themselves over 100.
I couldn't watch whales. I was devastated.
I wanted to go help so bad. I need to go do the whale rescue course.
There's a course?
Yeah, well, there was when I was at UTAS, when I was doing not a course, but like a training thing on how to rescue whales. And yeah, so at the time you just needed a wetsuit. It's probably moved on since then.
Put that in the show notes. There's so many things that I want to look at now from this discussion that I didn't get a chance to write down. I want show notes. Yeah, yes.
So it that actually, like, I was thinking about Eliza's book when that happened. Like, did you think about it too?
No, because I couldn't look at anything. I was just like, no. I just block. I turned TV off. I didn't look at any papers. I couldn't actually look at it because the first time I heard about it, I bawled.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So sad that they could save only
a few. Yeah.
So when that happened, I just, I was thinking about the book and about that scene. And then it made me think about, lots of things. Anyway.
I will say.
We don't need to talk about them.
No, thank you. Although I will say I saw something on news, I think it was this morning, and they were saying that they're able to take a lot of samples from the whales that didn't make it, and they're doing some good research into that, and they've got extra data from it. So at least like there's that. I don't know if that makes people feel better, but there's a concerted effort to look into why they did it, and well, there was before, but having, as much as it's awful that so many whales died, they have a lot of new data and a lot of new specimens from it. So, and that's been done here in Tassie. And part of me is like, I don't know how I feel about even the bodies being taken away and that done, but we have to, if we can't rescue them, we should at least try to learn what we can about why they beach or fly into windows.
And they can check to see what their health's like and stuff. Anyway, well, on that sad note, let's bring it back up again, shall we?
So we hope you enjoyed the interview. We did a lot. And read the book. It's highly suggested. If you think you would
like it.
You
can find it on Kindle.
Yeah.
If you don't want to get it in print copy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Widely available. You saw it in a few bookstores, did you say? I don't go into bookstores now because I have no money.
Yeah, I saw some in Melbourne. So
Yeah, so it's available. It's out there.
Yep.
So thank you, Eliza. We hope everyone enjoys this interview because we did.
We did. All right, and we'll catch you at the next one, people.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
I waved. No one can see that.